First of all, tell us what are the Monroe Monarchs? What was the Negro Baseball League, and what role did Monroe play in that league?
The Negro Baseball League had been around since the 1880s. It took on a form that we might recognize as a real league in 1920. But because of the Depression, it fell apart in 1931. It rose back up in 1933 and became the Negro Leagues that we all know, the Negro Leagues of Satchel Paige and Jackie Robinson and all those that we're more familiar with. Monroe was never really a part of any of those kind of big-time leagues in any of the history that we kind of know about the Negro League baseball era. But because the original league had folded in 1931, Monroe, who had a Negro League team that was a much smaller organization, was able to rise to the level of Major League team for one season in 1932. It ends up playing a very important role in the development of the Negro Leagues because Monroe's season in 1932 was incredibly successful. They made it all the way to the Negro World Series, and it was their success, this kind of standard of success and the response of other league owners to their success that ends up creating the new Negro League that comes in 1933. Monroe becomes this kind of crucial linchpin to developing the Negro Leagues from 1920 all the way until 1947 when Jackie Robinson integrates baseball.
So this book really looks a little bit at how Monroe played into that season.
Absolutely. The Monroe team had only been around for about 2 years whenever it had its major league season in 1932. It was started by a white natural gas field owner in the area who employed a lot of Monroe's black workers and had really started kind of a club team for them just to give them something to do. He ended up building them a very, very nice park, casino park, which was on Desired Street right behind where Carroll High School is today. At that time, it was right outside of the city limits. It was more than just a baseball field. It had swing pool, it had a casino, obviously, a dance pavilion. It had all these kinds of things that served as kind of this grand community center for the black population. It was never seen as kind of a breaking of the racial code because he employed a largely black workforce. And so it really allowed him a lot of leeway to do these kind of things, even though we are clearly in the era of Jim Crow segregation and things like that. As a real baseball fan, this guy, whose name was Fred Stovall, decided to really try to up the level of play and to start taking on free agents, and he begins buying players left and right whenever the older league starts to collapse, makes the Monroe team very, very formidable, and has this one kind of summer in the sun where Monroe steals all the national black headlines and really puts North Louisiana sports on the map for the first time.
What do you think Stovall saw in this team of gas and oil field workers that made him want to develop it into something bigger?
Well, Stovall actually came from Texas. He came from the Spindletop Wells. He was an oil man to begin with. That is one of the only real fields, especially in the South in the teens, 20s, and 30s, that had some kind of measure of integration. When he came up to Monroe, he considered himself to be kind of a forward-thinking guy, an outsider who had kind of bucking the trend of normal Deep South race relations and decided to kind of create this team. But more importantly than that, he was a real fan of baseball. This is a guy who came to Monroe, started one company, 2 months later started another one. By the time he was done, he owned five or six companies. He was very ambitious and very devoted to the game. And so that ambition, combined with the dumb luck of having the other leagues kind of fall apart around him, allowed him to kind of really just spend all this money and kind of live this one real glorious season. So I think it was this kind of pseudo-cosmopolitanism combined with a real business ambition that kind of pushed him in that direction in 1932.
And when he started acquiring players, he went after some of the guys that ended up in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Absolutely, absolutely. And many who didn't, but who at the time were considered to be real stars. I mean, he was buying players from the New York Black Yankees and the Cuban House of David. Towards the end of the season, while the Monarchs were playing a series against the team from Austin, Texas, the Austin Black Senators. He sees this kid, young kid, who's just blowing the Monarchs away, this guy named Hilton Smith, who at that time was undefeated. He had a 30-0 record on the season. He was just amazing. And so after the series was over, he actually bought Hilton Smith and brought him to Monroe. Hilton Smith would become the first player from Monroe to make it into the Hall of Fame. And this is, I should say, too, not into the Negro League's Hall of Fame in Kansas City. This is the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Hilton Smith, who always had a connection to Monroe, he met his wife here and he moved on. His great fame came with the Kansas City Monarchs throughout the 1930s and 40s. But he got his start, his real start, here in Monroe. A couple of years later, after the Monarchs had fallen down in status again in 1934 and 1935, they also featured a player named Willard Brown, who would also go on to really great success. And Willard Brown is now also in the Hall of Fame. So Monroe actually produces two Major League Baseball Hall of Famers, and countless numbers of their players are in the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City, but two that actually make it to Cooperstown.
What do you think it must have been like, not for some of those stars, but some of the local stars who suddenly were able to not only be playing baseball professionally, but playing it on a national level? What do you think that was like for a black man in Northeast Louisiana in 1930s?
It was a really big deal. It really was. Monroe, Louisiana was, even though we love it, was Washtenaw Parish was the most racially violent place per capita in the United States. There were more lynchings in Washtenaw Parish than there were anywhere else. It was an ugly place to be if you were black. And because of the Depression, baseball was a very difficult business to survive in if you were a player. But because Stovall had a really good reputation of always paying his players, of never skimping on paychecks, he owned a house where he essentially let the players live. It essentially became a dormitory for the players. They had three very fancy Ford automobiles that drove them to away games. They really lived a much better life than most baseball players did, even in big cities, because this was 1932, the worst year of the Great Depression. And so the people of Monroe had it really, really good. And you're right that many of these players who played for the Monarchs were local. And by having all this other out-of-town talent come in, they became stars. They really lived it up. As I mentioned, Hilton Smith meets his wife here. Many of the players do. Many of them come back to Monroe later in the 30s for reunion games and things like that. There's only one of the big players from 1932 who actually stayed and lived in Monroe, the second baseman named Augustus Saunders. And he actually stayed in Monroe until his death in the mid-90s. So we do have this real connection between the players and the town. Originally, that connection was largely centered on the connection between the players and Black Monroe, who used the team as kind of this respite from all the horrors of Jim Crow and segregation and all the things they had to go through living in a white town. But that ends up changing as the season progresses. Monroe at the time also had a white minor league team named the Monroe Twins, who played in this Class D minor league called the Cotton States League. Forsyth Park, across from Neville High School, used to be a baseball park, the first stadium with artificial lighting in North Louisiana, and they played there, but they were horrible. They were horrible in 1932. And we see this really interesting phenomenon in 1932 where even in a place that is so divided by race, all the fans of the white team, of the Monroe Twins, start gravitating towards these Monroe Monarchs games at the edge of town in these black neighborhoods, what was known at the time as the Booker T. Washington District of Monroe, because they wanted to see a winner. You know, everything was Depression. The unemployment rate was hovering in the 30s, the 30th percentile, and we see all these people who just want to see success. They want to see Monroe's name attached to something good, and we start to see more and more white fans gravitate. So these guys, these local players who had always essentially been victims of a system that didn't really treat them fairly, become stars not only to the black community in Monroe, but also to the white community. There was a point during the season where the local newspapers stopped referring to the team as the Negro Monarchs, and they start referring to them as us. They start using personal pronouns to describe the team and how they're playing. They get more and more coverage in the News Star and the papers of the day. And we really see that transition where these guys, because of the baseball team's success, really start to do well in everybody's eyes. And frankly, all of Black Monroe does the exact same thing. Black Monroe will see its violent crime rate drop to almost nothing. Black Monroe gets its first weekly newspaper during this season. By the end of the season, half of the stands at Casino Park are reserved for white fans. And in a couple of games that we know about where there was an overflow crowd that was so large that they couldn't accommodate that kind of segregated seating, they actually take the robes down, and there is integration in Monroe briefly in 32 when these black and white fans actually sit together because they all want to see the Negro League team play baseball. So, I mean, it really is significant, not only for the local players, but also for the fans who really get this kind of collateral success from the team and their victories.
Looking back on this, say, 80 years later now, was there a lasting effect on race relations in this area?
No. I wish I could say yes. There was a significant effect for the duration of 1932, but it largely goes away after that. Monroe will continue to be a relative embarrassment to the rest of the state as far as its race relations goes. As I mentioned, the team's only successful year was 32. After that, when it's not included in that new big league that comes around in 33, it goes back to being a relative barnstorming team. Race relations go back to essentially the way they were before. You have a lot of poor, white, depressed, angry people who usually end up in the South, especially scapegoating the black community for those kinds of things. Monroe will continue to have race issues. And of course, I think Monroe probably still does have race issues. We still have, you know, school segregation cases in the courts. We still have issues in Monroe that really haven't, you know, been completely solved. And certainly the success of one baseball team in one season can't fix that long term. But I do think it's significant that it fixed it briefly. We tend to normally think of the white South, especially in the Jim Crow era, as this kind of monolithic group who only thinks about race first and hates everybody who's not a white Protestant and, you know, all those kind of things. What this shows us is that's not always true. There are times when depression and everything else can kind of congeal a population, can bring black and white together. It's only temporary. But the fact that it could happen, I think, is significant in and of itself, even though it doesn't act as any kind of real salve for racial relations over the decades.
Dr. Thomas Aiello is an assistant professor of history at Valdosta State University in Georgia, but he's also going to be speaking on Monday night in the ULM Student Union Building as part of the celebration of Black History Month. We've been discussing his book, The Kings of Casino Park, Black Baseball in the Lost Season of 1932. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.